while you're finding your seats, you know, it's kind of a small world, and it's nice to not know a lot of things. I gave that example yesterday of Liberal Missouri that had, back in 1880, was established for, as a town for non-disbelievers, and someone comes up to me after my class and says their grandparents or great-grandparents lived there. I don't want to mention any names, but if you're interested, you can ask Marilyn Allen about her husband. But we will reiterate, my understanding is it wasn't that way very long, and it's a little town of about 400 people close to Kansas, about 5 or 6 miles, Tom told me, from the Kansas border. So it was Robert Persig who was quoted, or who said, "When one person suffers from a delusion, it's called insanity. When many people suffer from delusion, it's called religion." And that's the way many, many people view what we are about. We're delusional. Delusion is defined as a persistent false belief, and many claim religion to be exactly that. But in life and in relationships, I think we all engage in evidence-based faith. Seldom does absolute proof exist for many of our areas of life. Usually it's based on reliable track record and the evidence that we can glean. Is there evidence that God exists that can be the basis for our faith? The answer to that is absolutely. This is not a class so much to necessarily convince most of you of that, although maybe some of our younger people wrestle with that. But it is a class, I hope, to allow some of us who are older to be better able to defend and answer questions that come our way. We are not doing a very good job of teaching and answering questions for our younger people, in my opinion. If I could use a colloquialism in general, we stink at it. We teach them what we were taught. We teach them what we have learned. We are not necessarily teaching them all of what they need to learn. And we will have more on that in a moment. The atheist believes that life is rather simple. It's based upon DNA. And since in their view we are simply dancing to our DNA, no one can be blamed for anything. Aldous Huxley in 1946 wrote this: "I have motives for not wanting this world to have meaning. Consequently, I have assumed it has none, and was able, without any difficulty, to find satisfactory reasons for this assumption. The philosopher who finds no meaning in this world is not concerned with the problem in pure metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove only why it has no valid reason that he personally should not do what he wants to do, or why his friends should not seize political power and govern in a way they find most advantageous for themselves. For myself personally, the philosophy of meaninglessness is essentially an instrument of liberation, both sexually and politically. And once we convince ourselves that life is meaningless, then there are no gates, there are no fences. It's whatever we feel is appropriate." David Berlinski, in one of his writings, The Devil's Delusion, wrote, "If one is obliged to accept absurdity for fear of a divine foot, imagine what prodigies of effort would be required were the rest of the divine torso to be found wedged in the door of some justifiable irritation, demanding it to be let in." Now, he's not an atheist. What he was saying is, the world accepts irrational philosophies in order to keep the Lord's foot out of their lives. And they are willing to accept irrational philosophies because they so desperately want the Lord out of their lives. I'm going to begin this morning with a couple of sidetracks and a couple of questions that I received yesterday. If you're trying to find my follow my outline, I'm jumping around a little bit, which is one reason some don't give outlines. But I want to talk about determinism. I don't even know what page it's on, but it's in the first half. That's irrelevant. Determinism is the belief that all events are caused by things that happened before, and that man has no real ability to make choices or control what happens. You might term it very close to fatalism or predestination. Things have been determined. Who you were going to marry, whether you would be here, that's already been determined. So just sit back and enjoy the ride. Because you have no guidance, you have no input for the ride. And that has a tremendous effect on the worldview. It has a tremendous effect on Christian living. There is a slightly modified, you might, if you decide to study this in more detail, called interdeterminism, which simply says a few things are not determined, so it tries to give a little foothold to moral accountability, but it's a poor attempt at it. John Lennox does, and others, but John Lennox is a British apologetic speaker, and he did some nice work on this, and I will just simply share with you what I thought was a nice effort on his part. He said, determinism is the belief that our conduct is the result of our DNA and our hardwiring. Sin, therefore, is genetic. Sound familiar? It's a genetic issue, and also our belief in God is determined by our capacity to believe, and that is genetically determined. Now, that's not his belief, that's his explaining to us what this concept of determinism is. You sin, it's because you're genetically wired that way. You believe in God, it's because you're genetically wired that way. People who don't believe in God, it's not their fault, they just have bad genes, or good genes, depending upon your perspective. It's predetermined. He went on and said, Christianity, this is the determinist approach, Christianity is then perhaps a mental or genetic defect. If you're a Christian, it's because you're genetically presupposed to be a Christian, and if you don't agree with Christianity, you would view a Christian as a genetic mutant. Therefore, we are not accountable for sin. Almost all of this goes back to trying to keep us from being accountable for sin. Now, his comments on that. If this belief, Christianity, is chemically or genetically engendered, is not also the belief that Christianity is chemically or genetically engendered also chemically engendered? He nailed it. And we're going to see several times in my next few sessions how these arguments, if we will simply ponder them, collapse under their own weight. I'm going to try very hard to not make them laughable, because that would underestimate our enemy, maybe, in our minds. It's easy to get in a group like this and just poke fun and giggle and laugh at stupidity. But what good does that do us other than make us feel a little better? It doesn't help us fight the enemy, in my humble opinion. He goes on and says, would not then all beliefs be genetically induced? If you're a Republican, it's your genetics. If you're a Democrat, it's your genetics. If you're a communist, it's your genetics, and there's no end to it. Well, genetics have something to do with all of us, but they don't have anything to do with whether or not we are Christians. Our environment, yes. Our genetics, I believe not. This whole concept of delusionalism, you just find it all over the text that we have. Richard Dawkins, an atheist, wrote a book entitled The God Delusion. That was followed by a book by Alexander McGrath and called The Dawkins Delusion. That was followed by a book by David Ackman, The Delusion of Disbelief, which was then followed by a book by David Bernofsky, The Devil's Delusion. I guess if you want to sell a book, put delusion in the title. But there are delusions, aren't there? I'm going to read a quote now by Stephen Turner. Stephen Turner is a British journalist. He's an atheist. It's a little long quote, so I didn't type it. Again, my fingers get tired. So you will have to listen, if you choose to listen. It is taken from the Creed of Atheists, written by Stephen Turner, a British journalist. He said, "We believe in Marx, Freud, and Darwin. We believe everything is okay as long as you don't hurt anyone to the best of your definition of hurt and to the best of your definition of knowledge. We believe in sex before, during, and after marriage. We believe in the therapy of sin. We believe that adultery is fun. We believe that taboos are taboo. We believe that everything is getting better despite evidence to the contrary." That's an interesting statement. "The evidence must be investigated, and you can prove anything with evidence. We believe there's something in horoscopes, UFOs, and bent spoons. Jesus was a good man like Buddha, Muhammad, and ourselves. He was a good moral teacher, although some of his morals are basically bad. We believe that all religions are basically the same, at least the ones that we read were. We all believe in love and goodness. They only differ in matters of creation, sin, hell, and heaven, God, and salvation. We believe that after death comes nothing, because when you ask a dead person what happens, they say nothing. If that is not the end, and if the dead have lived, then it's compulsory heaven for all, except maybe Hitler, Stalin, and Genghis Khan. We believe in Masters and Johnson. What's selected is average, and what's average is normal, and what's normal is good. We believe in total disarmament. We believe that there are direct links between warfare and bloodshed. Americans should beat their guns into tractors, and the Russians would surely follow. We believe man is essentially good. It's only his behavior that lets him down. This is the fault of society. Society is the fault of conditions, and conditions are the fault of society. We believe that each man must... We believe that each man must find the truth that is right for him, and reality will adopt accordingly. The universe will readjust history, and history will alter. We believe that there are no absolute truths except the truth that there is no absolute truth." Again, that's an oxymoron. "We believe in the rejection of creeds, the following of individual thought. If chance be the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, troopers on the rampage, bomb blast schools, it is but the sound of man worshiping his maker," end quote. Now, I don't expect you to absorb all of that. You can Google it and read it, study it to the extent you want. But that's where this line of thinking takes us. Now, a slight aside. And poor John and Butch heard this real early this morning. I am in a bad mood. It happens. And when I get in a bad mood, the wise thing for me to do is extract myself from the presence of others, because I tend to show it. Well, let me explain what I mean by that. Our young people are being taught the things I've been talking about for the last 2 days or so in their educational systems, in the media, and in society. That is a fact. And Satan is taking a lot of captives. That is an absolute fact. It is a massacre in terms of numbers. How can that be if 1 John 4:4 is true? Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. How can that be true if what we have is greater than what the world has? Maybe part of the answer can be found in Romans chapter 13, verse 11 and following. "Knowing the time that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. This is a general statement, which I know doesn't apply to everybody, but it probably applies to all of us to some extent, brothers and sisters. I believe we are asleep. I have taught at 20-plus two-week meetings. Only twice in those times have I requested a topic. One of them was at Smart Road when I requested to teach Gnosticism, and I think John referenced that very briefly a couple of days ago. The other time was this year. Almost always the brethren up here, whether it's Labor Day or a two-week meeting, whenever I'm here, they almost always say, is there something you would like to teach on? And I almost always say, whatever you think. This year I did not, because I had a passion for this. And I need to share that passion with you a little bit now before we proceed. What are we doing? Fun in the sun? Or fun in the sun? Many of you have or will soon be retiring. That's a choice. Fun in the sun? More fun in the sun. How would Satan want us to respond to these holistic doctrines that we've been talking about? How would Satan want you and I to respond? That is exactly what Satan wants us to do. And I'm in a little bit of a bad mood because I think to a greater extent than is healthy, that is what we have and are doing. I believe the answer is meat, not in fads. There are all kinds of fads on how to make our congregations grow. There are all kinds of fads on how to keep our young people. I do not believe that is very often the appropriate answer because they have such a short shelf life. But I do believe meat is one of the answers. How many times have you heard, just in the few days we've been assembled, I can't believe they left. Talking about a young person or someone that's left the church. How many times do you hear that? Moses in the bulrushes is good. And we need to teach that. It's just not enough. Congregations that see growth almost invariably are teaching their young about some of the things we're talking about. Not to the exclusion of Moses and the bulrushes, or the plagues, or anything else. But brothers and sisters, those of us that are a little bit older, you cannot teach what you don't know. And generally, we're not teaching this because I don't think we know it well enough to teach it. We don't know what they're being bombarded with. Therefore, we can't and don't answer their questions. And they can't and don't answer us because they know we can't. So they leave. If we don't know, we can't and won't teach. Why are we having this class? I hope we're having this class. I want us to have this class. I asked for this topic so that the younger will be able to understand maybe better the folly of some of the things that are being taught, and pray to God that those of us that are older will have the guts and the knowledge and the courage to teach them. And that will take work. You can regurgitate the plagues. You can regurgitate the Ten Commandments. You can regurgitate this and that. And we need to have that repetition. Please don't misunderstand me. But those are not the issues that are causing our young people to leave and some of our older people to leave. We are not losing people because Satan is stronger. We are losing people because we're asleep at the switch, in my opinion. And I need a mirror up here in order to make that statement. Each of us need to ask ourselves, can we combat and refute these doctrines of Satan? 1 Timothy 4:1, I told you yesterday, we put it up, seducing spirits and doctrine of the devils. Isn't it our job to be able to refute and explain to people why those things aren't true? If we can't, why can't we? Or why don't we? I think everybody here wants to refute these things. Let me rephrase that. I want to think everybody here wants to refute those things. I think we want to refute them. I just sometimes question, do we want to put the work in that will allow us to do it? I want to play the piano. Problem is, I don't want to put the work in to learn how to play the piano, and it doesn't work that way, does it? If we can't combat this, at least in our own families and congregations, the results that you are seeing in your families and congregations, I can almost guarantee you, will simply continue. What's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting things to change. I am not talking about programs. I am not talking about fads. I do not believe the strength of the church is in programs and fads. I believe the strength of the church is in its virtue and in the truth. Must pablum be their diet? Must pablum be their diet? Young people, and one of the reasons they schedule these classes is not because I'm a good teacher. They wanted the young people to be up here so they could hear it. It's fine. Young people, it is simply going to be a fact. You may have to teach yourselves on a lot of these issues because there may not be any grown-ups around you that are willing or capable to do it. I hate to say that. I simply think it is a fact. And you cannot hide under the guise of nobody taught me, because we work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. So strap on your boots and have at it. I want to emphasize, amongst other things, that much of what you are being taught is so easily refuted, it is so shameful that we don't. If I can learn it, and there's a lot I haven't learned, everybody here can learn it. The gospel never changes, but Satan's doctrines do. We don't want to change the gospel. No. But we do have to. You know, it's like people saying, well, the musket won the Revolutionary War, so it can win the next war. Well, weapons change. A musket's not going to do very good. I do believe methodology changes are usually fool's gold. They make people think they're making progress, and that's not the issue. I believe content is the priceless treasure, not methodology. How many times have you heard somebody say, I can't believe, and they'll put a name to it, that they left. They were taught. You know what my first reaction is? Were they? Were they? Man, I feel better. But I'm not sure I should. I just want you to know why I'm up here and why I requested this topic. I don't think this class is more important than any other class. How can anything be more important than passages from Scripture? But maybe this is a more scoring issue for us. I had a couple of questions, and this one is kind of this was really a comment / question. I was talking yesterday about pantheism, and one of the weaknesses of pantheism, it says that God is in everything. Well, if God is in everything, then evil exists, so God must in some way be in evil or evil in God, and that's a non-starter for the biblical worldview. And it led to a discussion, I want to just comment a little bit today on the will of God. You hear people say, well, whatever happened, it was the will of God. Was it? How do you know? How do you know that was the will of God? Was it the will of God that Cariella died this week? Well, that leads to the real question, is all that happens God's will? Well, I don't have any difficulty saying with some volume, absolutely not. In fact, most of what happens is not God's will. We often use the term God's will in a comforting way. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9, it's not God's will that any should perish. Are most people going to perish? The Bible teaches us that the broad way and the narrow way. Revelation chapter 22, verse 17, which I don't think is one of the chapters Rick had, so I'll comment on it just a little bit. It's God's will that we would all come and drink of the fountain of life. Are most people going to do that? Again, no. The most common thing that man does is not God's will, because the most common thing man does is sin. We're best at it. Is that God's will? Well, that's obviously a rhetorical question. The phrase, it was the will of God, is often a comfort phrase, but I'm just saying, let's be very careful that we don't wrongly blame God for things that God did not do. I know it's comforting when somebody dies or somebody gets sick. Well, it was God's will. Well, there may be times when that was, but I think in most times probably it wasn't, but I don't want to blame God for that. It is a form of responsibility escapism, which is what all of these satanic doctrines are. They're escapism from being accountable for our actions. Whether it's atheism, whether it's modernism, whether it's postmodernism, whether it's secularism, whether it's humanism, whether it's anyism. I do, however, believe, and I want to just comment on this because this question comes up, and parents, grandparents, your children are going to wonder about this if they're thinking children at all. How does free will and the sovereignty of God match up? If God is sovereign, which means He's over all, how can I say that His will is not always done? I'm just going to pause for a minute. And you think in your mind, how would you answer that if some young person in your congregation asked you that? Well, I believe the issue, or at least I've resolved it in my own mind, and I'll simply share my thinking, is God's will is always done in process, if not in actuality. If God's will, the question is not always done, then how can He be sovereign? Things are happening that aren't His will, so He's not in control. Yes, He is. Because God's will is always done in process, in that it is God's will that we have free will choice. When I sin, is that God's will? No. But the fact that I can sin is God's will, because He gave me choice. He is a sovereign, all-powerful God, and He is so powerful that He can delegate choice to us and remain sovereign. So when somebody says, is God's will always done, that's a yes and no question. No, it is not always done, in that what He wants to be done is done, but it is always done, I believe, in process, because he allowed us those choices. While our actions may not accord with God's will, the fact that we can choose is his will. In that sense, his will is always done, and he therefore remains sovereign. Now, I don't think that's overly complicated. But those are the types of questions that people have legitimate right and should expect an equipped soldier of the Lord to be able to share. I had one other question, and the person didn't sign their name, and that's fine. I appreciate that. I am going to say to whoever gave this question, if you don't mind, put in the question box whether you're going to be here next week or not. You don't have to sign your name, and that'll let me know whether to address this in more detail this week or save it till next week when I was going to. But I'm going to comment on it. The question's going to be far better than the answer, but you're used to that with me. Question: since we send our kids to school 8 or more hours a day to be educated about life in this world, how do we as parents use the few hours we have left to unteach or shape their thoughts to think through the eyes of God and have a biblical worldview? Their thoughts about origin, meaning, morality, and destiny are being shaped by humanism every day of the week at school. How do I counter teaching by the few hours I have with them every evening or at a two-week meeting each year? Well, the last part's easy. You're not going to counter that with a two-week meeting every year. I don't care if you come to every one of these. That's just not enough. It's like parents who send their kids to VBS and expect us to do in 1 week what they undo the other 51 weeks. It won't work. It can augment, but it won't undo it. I guess I would kind of go back to my soapbox. First of all, we've got to study and train ourselves on these issues so that we can answer those questions and respond rather than being a deer in headlights. If your grandchild or child asks you why modernism is wrong, what would you tell them? I'll get back to you. Well, that's not the worst answer, because you don't want to tell them something you haven't looked at. I'm just saying, can't we be somewhat prepared? I think sometimes we also underestimate our influence as parents in the home or pillars in our congregation. I think our young people really do look up to most all of us. Sometimes I wish they didn't, at least in my case. But they do. And you've got a real leg up if you can give a credible response. Yeah, they're going to look up to some of their teachers. But teachers aren't all that smart. At least that's been my experience. Maybe one or two exceptions in America, but not many. They're average people. Yes, our children spend a lot of time with them, but no, they don't spend more time with them than they do you. And you've got them those first few years when, boy, they're so malleable. But a credible answer or a credible response if you have to research it. We're going to talk more about that when we get to the family and as part of Satan's attack on the church, and part of that will be Satan's attack on the family. If the person who gave me that question isn't going to be here next week, let me know somehow, and I'll go into more detail this week. But if you're going to be here next week, then I'll just keep kind of my normal schedule. I want to now go into a section for a moment on evidences for God. This will hopefully be review for many of you, but it's good review, and maybe some of the young people haven't gone through this, and maybe some of us that are older have forgotten it. There are three classical classifications of arguments that we can give for God does exist. The first is called the cosmological argument, which is just a long word. But it means everything that exists has a cause. And since the universe and the world exist, there had to be a first cause. Something had to cause it. If you read scientific articles on the creationism from a religious standpoint, you'll find the phrase ex nihilo. Ex nihilo is Latin for from nothing. And it's a wonderful, wonderful point. Evolutionists tell us that we came from this, and then this came from that, and that came from this, and you keep going back until you get to this little cesspool of organic material in the ocean that turned into something. And I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but they never can answer where did the original whatever come from. Something had to come from nothing. And the cosmological argument is basically saying, since this is something, it had to come from something. The universe had to begin. We often use the word now. You cannot have a now unless you have a beginning. Because now is a component of time. And time has to have a beginning. Time is unlike eternity. In eternity, I don't think there'll be a now. I think everything will be a now. Now, I can say that, I can believe it, but I can't grasp it. If there is no time, and I believe in eternity there is no time, everything must be happening now. Maybe that's why God told Moses, when Moses said, who's going to send me? He said, I am that I am. What is that? God is saying, I'm always in the present tense. Because God doesn't have a past and He doesn't have a future. Now, the Bible talks in past and future tense, but that's so you and I can grasp it. Because we're not in eternity yet. The cosmological argument simply says that if something exists, it had to have a cause. The second one that we remind ourselves of is called the theological argument. And you've heard this example. Maybe you haven't heard the word theological. That, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. The world or the creation is so complex and so ordered that it had to have been designed and created by some intelligent being. The old example is you can't just take all these pieces of a clock and throw them up and expect them to turn into a clock when they hit. You can't take all the words that we have and throw them up and expect them to organize themselves into a dictionary. Order, complexity, require an orderer of that complexity. And I think that's a very valid one. The other argument that we will just briefly comment on, and you can research these more on your own, is called the moral argument. We'll talk more about this. Tomorrow I'll probably spend a whole session on the problem of evil, and the moral argument really wraps itself around the problem of evil. But preliminary to that, the moral argument states that since man has a conscious concept of what is right and wrong, and mankind does have that, we don't necessarily behave that way, but we know what's right and wrong, and that's why our consciences do or don't hurt us. In order for man to have what he has, some sense of right and wrong, there must be a higher consciousness or moral attribute of what is right or wrong. This is the concept, is if there is right, there has to be wrong. Or if there is wrong, there has to be right, would be a better way for me to say it. If there is right, where did that concept of right come from? Well, it had to come from a higher conscious order of right. And Christianity believes in what is called objectionable moral values. Pluralism, postmodernism, believe in subjective moral values. Whatever Mark thinks is right, that's right for him. Whatever I think is right, that's right for me. The problem is, Mark and I may not think the same things are right, and we've got a contradiction. Well, in a pluralistic society, of which we have, that's not a problem. Mark, you do your thing. John, you do your thing. But in a world biblical view, that does not work, because what Mark thinks is right and what I think is right is totally irrelevant. It's what God thinks is right that's relevant, isn't it? And that is our moral standard. Okay. I hope I said all these things, so pardon me. I think we covered that one. Okay. I didn't give you Romans 12, 14, and 15. You can note that if you want to and take a look at it later. Now, how would Satan want man to respond to these evidences that there is a God? How would Satan want man to respond to that? I was going to say, if you haven't figured out what's coming next, you need to wake up. That's how he wants us to respond to that. And again, I'm not trying to be flippant, but if you got sand in your hair, I don't know if I'll have time to do too much with this. Let me just jump ahead. I want to come back to this, and I'll probably do that tomorrow. So just pretend like you didn't see that slide, although it is in your notebook. But I've got about 8 minutes left. So, and we've been talking about the meaning of life, and I touched on this yesterday, but not in great detail. I believe life has meaning because of two things: God and immorality. And this is not to lessen God, but if God, I said immorality, I meant immortality. If God is not immortal and we are not immortal, then I don't think life has meaning. And let me explain. That does not denigrate our God, because our God is immortal. If those two things don't exist, life is absurd. It makes absolutely no sense. Suicide is probably a logical option if those two things don't exist. I don't want any of us to do that, please. But it makes perfect sense. If life simply ends in death, where is its meaning? If life becomes without significance, it becomes without value, and it becomes without purpose, and that's why so many people are floundering emotionally and mentally in their lives and in their relationships. Most of us find death a little terrifying. And if you don't find death terrifying, which I think that wanes a little bit as we get older, dying is a little trepidatious, because none of us know how that's going to feel or what it's going to be like. Every time I do a funeral, I wonder, what is that person doing right now? Well, I don't know for sure. And all the people that know can't come back and tell us. But it even terrifies children, until they come to grips with it. John Paul Sartre said, whether it's a few hours or a few years, once you have lost eternity, it doesn't matter. And man, he nailed it. If there is not eternity, this life doesn't matter. If after I'm done here on this earth, that's the end of it, what does it matter what I do while I am here? Now, if you have an answer for that, I'll be here for another week and a half. It just doesn't matter. If all we do is live and die, then our lives have no more significance than a barnyard of pigs or a swarm of bees. Because that's what they do. If we live merely to die, and that's what I think most people do, our lives can have no purpose. All of the achievements, all of the great things that man has done are ultimately buried in a universe with no meaning if there is no God and if there is no eternity. Those are the things that make the difference. Why live as a saint rather than Hitler, if everybody's fate is going to be the same? But we need not only immortality, but obviously we need God. If we only have immortality without God, there is still no right or wrong. There's just eternity, but there's no right or wrong. There are no values. There's no good and evil. Without these, there is still no significance to life except longevity. And longevity is not a virtue. It may be a pleasure. And please, I know we've got many examples of this here, and God bless you, but I inside me, when I'm trying to not show what I'm really thinking, which I'm not very good at, people will extol someone who's been married 60 or 70 years. Or they've lived, lady in Clarinda, Iowa, she just had her 103rd birthday as a member of the church. Well, that's kind of wonderful, but that's longevity, that's not quality. You can be married for 70 years and it can be one of the most hellish things you ever lived through, I guess. You can live a life of 103 years and be lost. Longevity is not the virtue. Longevity with the quality is what the virtue is. But if God exists, then our lives are infused with eternal significance beyond longevity. So that's why I picked these two. If God doesn't exist, we have longevity without virtue. And if only God exists without immortality, it's all going to end, so why worry about it? Well, obviously God is both, so we can't separate those. And please don't take my comments in any way sacrilegious. I'm just saying those are the two components that we have to come to grips with. And how wonderful that is. We can enjoy God forever. Cariella is enjoying God. Well, he's the judge, not me, but from her life, she's enjoying God now more than she ever did before, and it will never end. That's probably why Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, O grave, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? And this makes the moral choices, however, of this life so much more significant. Young people, if there was not an eternity, then all of these choices that older people are urging you to take in the right direction, it doesn't matter. But there is, so it does. And let me look at the front half of the crowd. It matters for you too. It matters for me. So it is, God and immortality that I believe are the real crucial elements of life. This has been a little preachy, and I don't really apologize for that. You may or may not have cared for it. But I really think it is so important. So many people are saying, well, our young people are leaving, our congregations are shrinking, and maybe that is inevitable in some cases. But let's at least teach what is pulling against what is pulling them away. I don't know too many young people that have left the church because they didn't understand Moses went down in an ark in the bulrushes. Now, we need to teach them that. But those are not the questions that are eating at their soul. That's not what they're being bombarded with. So maybe we need to wake up. Getting people to teach our teenage classes in our congregation is sometimes the hardest post to fill. It may be the most important post. I don't think many times our trepidation is they won't understand. I think our trepidation is I don't understand, so how am I going to teach it? So we fall back into what we're comfortable with. When people leave the church, no matter what their age is, I believe it almost always is a worldview issue. Somehow, some way. And that's what we've got to combat. Yes, we have to talk about how fornication is wrong, how all these things are wrong. But those are worldview, those are the symptoms of the worldview issues. And we owe it to one another to, shall I say, challenge ourselves a little bit more, in my humble opinion. I was going to open it up and say, does anybody have a comment? But it looks to me like We don't have any time left.